Greetings again, crew. I'm back with part two of the audio commentary on Crew Notes number 22, The Central Riddle of Correction. And obviously, before I get to the cut to the chase, I'm covering some other material here simply because that's what's come up in front of me, and it is my pleasure to do so right now. Moving ahead to some remarks in follow-up to the Dumavati encounter. There you'll see the line from Voyage au bout de la nuit by Louis Ferdinand Céline. And you see the original French. C'est peut-être ça qu'on cherche à travers la vie, rien que cela. Le plus grand chagrin possible pour devenir soi-même avant de mourir. And, could be translated. Maybe it's that we're looking for through life. Nothing but that. The greatest dose of grief possible to become yourself before you die. You know, the French term devenir soi-même literally means to become yourself. But my understanding in the spirit of Dumavati is to become a human, become yourself as a human animal. And that is to say, a social animal who is also a real, authentic person. And not merely a social dupe or a conformist running on Mephisto rules. Remember that the unique characteristic of Dumavati, the floater, the widow, is that she has no shift. She does not fall in to the phase model of the Dakini shifts timed with the lunar cycles. She does not fall into an exact or fixed correlation with a zodiacal constellation, although she does appear to be more closely associated with Tantra Mother and Bhairavi than with any of the other Gayan Dakinis or Mahavidyas. And so if you want to give her a place in the constellations, you can sort of picture her as hovering between the crab, which is correlated to Vajrayogini or Tantra Mother, and the lion, Sekhmet Bhairavi, Simamukha, and so forth. She's the drifter. I can't say or dictate to you how to picture this Mahavidya. I can only tell you what I saw. I can only tell you the unforgettable impression she made on me. Like I said, I pictured a lean woman dressed like a gypsy in a long sleeve blouse and a long skirt. And her posture was vivid to me. A posture of a woman sitting in that way that women have when they draw up their legs, draw up their feet, so she could lean forward and lay one forearm across her knees. Her legs and her knees would be shifted slightly off the vertical, say to her right, angled slightly to her right, with her right forearm over her knees, and then her left arm could be extended down along her leg as if she were reaching down to her ankle. This is a position that women can assume, and men as well. It's a spontaneous position. And typically, the way someone would sit on a bench or sitting in a doorway or a windowsill, leaning to the right. So that's how I pictured her. And the picture corresponds to her MO. That is to say, she comes to the threshold of the tonal and really enters the tonal in a way that the other devatas do not. The drifter visits you in the tonal. The tonal is the sum total of your facets of self-perception and self-description as they are arrayed around your aura, the luminous egg, as Castaneda called it. Facets of self-description, the pretenses that she removes because you are incapable of removing them yourself. It is, needless to say, extremely poignant to have an encounter with Dhumavati. And the consequences of it are certainly far-reaching. Bear in mind that if tonal is the social world in which human animals live, and the presence of Dhumavati and her instruction, if you will, through the instrument of grief, is to remove those pretenses that do not allow you to be all you can be as a social animal, an effective and genuine person in the time and setting where you live. And she is the sweeper. She has a broom. And that broom is your own grief. And with the broom of grief, of your grief, she sweeps away the pretenses that no longer serve you. I can't express, I have no words to describe the gratitude that I feel for my Dhumavati encounter, that I felt when I was going through it, and that I continue to feel. In that spirit, I'd like to just read this letter that came in from Stockholm a day or so ago. Hi, John. Great to hear your voice and to know that you are doing well. Thanks for your recent briefings on Dhumavati and the power of the narrative. Inspiring talks. I will not disregard anything concerning the name of the Sophia Tulpa, Mantis, or Melchizedek. Dhumavati's presence is sweeping around here in Stockholm, too. Her style brings a liberating release on many of the pretenses that I've been carrying around. I sense a delightful playfulness that is unraveling within me. She is really taking out the garbage, recycling the facets of myself and things from the past. I wasn't aware of it first, but after listening to your briefing, I could see Dhumavati's handling in a clearer way. I can detect and recognize her analyzing treatments by looking at my fearless acts in the tonal. She is like a divine remedy to our impediment that is holding us back to act out what we need to do for ourselves. By my acts, I get access to certain pretenses that have been holding me back or are holding me back to express my full potential and desires. I love her smooth power expansions that handles me without even noticing it. Here in Sweden, everybody is hyping and talking about a film or TV series that is called The Bible. It is so annoying to hear these people talk about this, particularly those who I meet and have conversations with. They show that they don't have a critical scrutiny to their own beliefs and have never questioned the authenticity of their own religious narrative that they believe in and talk about. Many of the conversations I've had with people have been on the ethnic themes, cultures, and religions, and how all of the world cultures and pre-religions have been suppressed by the Abrahamic religions. And when you explain in a clear manner to these people the facts that these religions, Abrahamic religions, have invaded, suppressed, and brought genocide to cultures and countries all over the world, pagans, Indians, and all the African people, and the list goes on and on. We all know how these conversations end when you talk to people that just can't admit that they have invested their lives in big lies that are operating around us. Mephisto rules. Their answers, when you bring this up, is that these religions are in their origin and core a message of love, and that people that do harm to others have misinterpreted its true messages and origin. I just can't stand ignorant and naive people anymore, sometimes my own family and friends. And the funny thing is that they can't argue about anything because their arguments are not valid anymore. I can give an example. I asked a person, why is the great lie, the religious narrative of Christianity, so big over all the world? Answer from the person, because there is truth in it. Baffled, I answered this person, the religious narrative has been so big because it has been imposed on people. The person becomes stunned and then angry because it is the truth. And he ended up leaving me in the middle of the conversation, hopefully with grief. They can't handle the truth. These days, they all get a memorable experience from me, and I deliver a big packet of grief and anger that I feel. The obvious facts that we people are being fooled and tricked by the narrative, by a narrative, and much more, can't be denied, at least not in my presence. Enough about the problems, but the joy I feel to just respond to these people and to the lies that are operating around me, representing the Kalika Warrior Party, makes me feel so real. Swandeva Shift was an amazing ride with so much joyful spontaneity and delightful thrills. I am so excited about the Chinnamasta Shift and anticipating to watch the Sunset Crescent today. Thank you. All the best. Daniel. And that's a crew message from Stockholm. Thank you, Daniel. And I must say, you're not the only one who's written me, resonating to my comments about the Dumavadi encounter with grief and how cleansing and cathartic it is. You know, when you get to see through your own pretenses, you see the world around you more clearly as a social animal. And yeah, shit, yeah, you see the pretenses in which entire societies are embedded. You know, the Abrahamic religions are lies, and they are terrible, archontic errors that infect a human mind. And over the centuries, human animals have constructed their pretenses based on these lies. So, for instance, the first one that comes to mind, and it's an obvious one to me because I grew up in a small Christian community, Christians have the pretense that they are loving people, that they love their brothers and sisters. They have the pretense that they are better than non-Christians who do not follow the divine command to love. But that's just a pretense, and it's not a pretense that serves the world very well when you look at the application of Christian love and of people who claim to be Christians. It doesn't serve the human world, nor the animal world, nor the planet terribly well, but they hold on to that pretense for dear life. Obviously, people are reluctant to receive a visit from Dumavadi. They do not want to lose their pretenses, because to most people, that is the equivalent of destroying their self-description. I welcome the selective destruction of my pretenses. I watch with joy and gratitude as they shatter like fragments of glass onto the ground, and Dhumavati sweeps them away across the threshold of my reality, leaving me a freer and more authentic person. It's difficult to estimate the extent to which your behavior would be changed by this Dhumavati encounter. We all struggle with our own pretenses, and it's difficult, that being the case, it's difficult to face and challenge the pretenses in the social world. So one of the things that Dhumavati does is leaves you, like Daniel, with a much more rigorous view and a much more ruthless attitude toward the pretenses carried by others. Of course, we don't take inventory of anyone else's pretenses. That's a rule for the Dhumavati experience. We don't count the pretenses of other people, but you can't help encountering them and giving people grief for the pretenses they hold is a wonderful practice. And here's one crew member who's taking it on, obviously with pleasure and with pride. And it's wonderful and encouraging to hear accounts like this, when this is really planetary tantra in action. Along with the crew notes, number 22, I've also posted a couple of photographs. One of them is a photo of Louis Fernand Céline. This would have been taken toward the end of his life. He died in July of 1961. Interestingly, very close to the time of the death of C.G. Jung. And June or July, I can't quite remember. I think it was beginning of June. Céline is one of my great heroes, and was a tremendous influence in my adolescence, as I mentioned in the Dhumavati talks. This is a picture of Céline in his garden in the place where he lived near Paris at the end of his life. And beneath it, there's a quote from a paper or document he wrote in 1941. Céline wrote a number of documents which can be called, in addition to his many novels, he wrote what are called polemics. They were extremely controversial in their time because they appeared to be anti-Semitic. In my view, Céline was not an anti-Semite or someone who hated Jews, and other people have argued this as well, although the greater bulk of the argument would have him be so. Céline was also a doctor, a practicing physician, and he was the medical consultant to a number of leading Nazis, and that also caused some controversy. And all in all, in his life, he was an extremely controversial person. But in the so-called tractates that Céline wrote, dealing with certain hot political subjects around the time of World War II, he talked about racism. And there's a little quote here. "We do not think enough about the protection of the white Aryan race. Now is the time to act, because tomorrow will be too late." And those words were written in 1941. "I have the white Aryan race and the protection of the white Aryan race a lot on my mind these days. And in forthcoming NAB briefings, I'll see what I can say about that." Why is the subject of race on my mind? Well, as I said, race is a huge part of the problem on this planet. It's a huge part of what's wrong with the divine experiment. It's a huge part of what prevents the divine experiment, what throws it into confusion in human minds and prevents human animals from coming together to realize the transsocial and transpersonal objectives of this experiment. Race is obviously an extremely divisive factor in human experience, or at least it can be. But I'm here to give you the good news, which is that race is also part of the solution. Race and the recognition of what race actually is and what racial difference actually is, yes, is something positive, something that we need, and it is a huge part of the human role in Sophia's correction. As I said in one of the Dhumavadi talks, the agenda of enforced race mixing as a social program is evil. But spontaneous and elective race mixing is a beautiful, beautiful thing and is a beautiful part of the human adventure. I'm also including with this set of crew notes a photograph of Alexandra Shevchenko, speaking of the white race. She is, of course, Ukrainian, white Russian. And I don't know if you know anything about the genocide of the Ukrainian people that happened in the early part of the 20th century. It didn't happen. This is not the correct language. I don't know if any of you know the story of how the Jewish Bolshevik communists who hijacked the Russian Revolution perpetrated a horrific genocide on the Ukrainian people, the white Russians. You know, there was a civil war in Russia, as there is likely to be in the United States soon, between the red Russian armies, who are the instrument of the Bolsheviks, whose ideologues were exclusively Jewish, and the white armies, or the white revolutionaries, who actually retained the true and original spirit of the Russian Revolution as a social uprising for the betterment of the Russian people. According to the Bolshevik agenda, that was never the objective. The objective was never the benefit and well-being and improvement of life for the Russian people. That was never the plan of the Bolsheviks. So, look at this picture of one of the members of the Femen movement, F-E-M-E-N, which is a Ukrainian women's liberation movement. You can see a demonstration of some of their naked antics on YouTube. I have another picture of Alexandra Shevchenko on my wall here, along with my navigational diagrams and the buffalo-headed Yamantaka and things of that sort. And there she is, standing in a field of snow, and she's got her long blonde hair hanging down, and she's naked, and written across the top of her chest says, "Death for Patriarchy," and she's holding up a piece of paper or a placard the size of a page of typing paper that has "War" written across it, and she's holding that across her pelvis. And so there's this blonde, white, naked, 20-something Ukrainian woman standing there in the snow, in a field of snow. And I look at this picture, as you can well imagine, a few times a day, my eyes wander in that direction. And I'll tell you what I'm thinking about when I look at this picture. I'm thinking about myself, because I'm a member of the same race as she is. And I'm thinking about being a white man, being a member of the white race. And I like to have her picture up there and the impact of that nubile Russian woman, the impact of that nakedness, because it reminds me of something that I would otherwise tend to forget, which is that my race is at risk of extinction. You know, I've never thought of myself as belonging to a race that's under threat of extinction. On the contrary, what does the narrative say? The narrative says that colonialism and corporate fascism are instruments of the white race, and due to an agenda of white race supremacy, certain people of other races on this planet have been persecuted and have suffered affliction and genocidal assault. So the prevailing narrative that I grew up with told me that the white race has a supremacist agenda, and that the white race is bad news to people who are not white because it's has a history of oppressing those who are not white. And of course, the cardinal example that is used is the Nazis with their racial supremacy ideology. Now, that's a story that has a certain element of truth in it, but by and large, the narrative of the Nazis and their racial supremacist agenda is a subsection of the Holocaust narrative. I've come to see now that the demonization of the Nazis for what they were not and for what they did not do is part of a larger agenda directed against the white races, including the Nordic and Scandinavian peoples of Europe and the white races of the Ukraine and of Russia. And so I feel a great sympathy for those people. And I would say that Alexandra Shevchenko stands there naked in the snow as my sister and my compatriot in the cause of the white race. Racial hatred is a riddle that must now be solved. During the Swan Deva shift, I received some startling insights regarding the problem of race and regarding how race and the recognition of racial differences without a forced mixing of races can be extremely beneficial. And the time has come for this enormous issue to be seen and to be resolved. And I consider the resolution of the problem of race on this planet to be an indication of Sophia's correction. One of the leading, two or three leading indications. So it may seem at first somewhat odd or anomalous or awkward or inappropriate to you out there listening to me, whether you be in Planetary Tantra or not, whether you be in the GNE or not. It may seem a bit odd and inappropriate when I go off on a riff about race. But stay tuned, because I have some things to say, and I guarantee you, you've never heard them before. The one thing I want to say about the white race right now, in the context of this particular moment, is this. The white race to which I belong, in common with the Germanic or Teutonic peoples, in common with the Scandinavian peoples and the white Aryan nations, can be recognized not for its supremacy to other races, that is and always was a false and distorted claim, but in its excellence, in the excellence of what it has achieved. The Irish, for instance. I'm half Irish. Look at the excellence of what the Irish have achieved in civilization, in culture, in literature. Look at the excellence of what the Germans have achieved in music, in literature, in philosophy, in the arts, in engineering. Look at the excellence of what the white race has achieved, and do not condemn it for supremacist attitudes. All races aspire to excellence, not to supremacy. And all races can distinguish themselves by the excellence of their behavior and their cultural and material and spiritual expressions. And it is in the excellence of the different nations of this planet, and in the combination of those different kinds of excellence, that the divine experiment on this planet succeeds. And as a white person who carries the stigma of racial supremacy, and who stands now as a target of discrimination and elimination, I am the first to make the case for excellence. That would be the Greek word arete, A-R-E-T-E. The white race has shown excellence in its talent and in the expression of human potential through the particular filter of that race. So have the black races, the brown races, the red and the yellow races. They have all shown different kinds of excellence. And now is the time to reclaim the power and pride of that excellence. Because it is this concept of arete, or excellence, going out across the land, going out to the nations, that awakens them to the individual and indigenous genius of those nations. And that is her wish, that awakening to the indigenous genius of the nations and the ethnic groups is her wish for the success of this experiment. This is what I have to say today, at this moment, about the white race to which I belong. And in that perspective, I can add this navigational detail, two details actually. I can signal you to some upcoming factors in the navigation process, which are specific mythological and constellational factors. And as these mythic and constellational factors come into play, the issue of race comes into play for solution. It comes up for solution, big time. One of those constellations is extra ecliptic. It lies below the line of the ecliptic where the sun, moon, earth, and planets typically move. And that would be the constellation of Hydra, or the great water serpent. This is a massive constellation that stretches along the length of the ecliptic. Looking at Stellarium or some other chart, you may have on hand some book of the zodiac, you'll see that the head of the massive water dragon is formed by a cluster of stars positioned just under the constellation of the crab. Now, viewing Hydra or Idra from the northern hemisphere, the body of the serpent stretches to the left from there. And so it actually stretches in a kind of a zigzag fashion beneath the constellation of the lion. It continues to beneath the constellation of the Virgin, and by the time you reach the head of the Virgin, you've actually scanned about the front half of this long, extremely long constellation. In fact, it's the longest constellation in the sky. And it continues, the lower half of the water snake's body continues and can actually be imagined, as I pictured it many years ago, as extending all the way to the constellation of the scales. And one way I depicted this years back was that I showed the tail of the water serpent, Hydra, curling around the vertical shaft that forms the fulcrum of the scales, therefore making some kind of association between the water dragon serpent and the constellation of the scales, which represents ethics and a fair balance in human society, a fair balance of resources in human society, the fair sharing of resources, you could say. So that is the constellation I introduce now as part of, as a factor in the navigational process that I'm pursuing. And I would just say, as an opening clue, that Hydra represents race. If you read the traditional myth, what is Hydra? Well, according to the Greek sources or Greek language sources, it was an ancient serpent-like water animal, a phonic animal, that is, it belonged to the ultimate subterranean powers of the earth, or it came out of the earth, and it possessed many heads. And for each head that was cut off, it grew two more. And it also possessed a poisonous breath and blood that was so virulent that it caused death or extreme anguish if any of it happened to spatter on you. The Lernaean Hydra is a figure in the 12 labors of Hercules. So, I submit to you that this image of the watery serpent coming out of the earth, who grows two heads for each one that is cut off, with its poisonous breath and its toxic blood spatter, is the perfect image of racial division on this planet. And in the time to come, certain indications, certain of the astronomical indications of correction, bring this constellation to the fore. They bring this constellation to our attention, and particularly through the alignments of its prominent marking star known as Alpha Hydrae, whose name would be Alphard. A-L-P-H-A-R-D, marked by the Greek letter Alpha in the constellation of Hydra. And that star marks not the head or face or jaw of the serpent, the water serpent, but traditionally it marks the backbone of the serpent. In addition to the navigational clue presented by this constellation, I'd like to draw your attention also to the constellation of the goatfish. As the 3 years of Sophia's correction conclude, the 3 years of setting the initial conditions, the lunar perigee moves into the goatfish. And in fact, when completion, with the completion of this three-year process, that is actually where it comes to be situated. You can hear more about those particulars of upcoming perigee movements in the nav briefing, number 58, that stands as a kind of counterpart to these two audio commentaries on the crew notes. So finally, here at the 43-minute mark of the second part of my audio commentary, we come down to the main topic of this commentary and the crew notes, which is the central riddle of correction. So let me repeat the provisional syntax. I present it in the form of a question. Central riddle is, how does Sophia's intervention from within the terrestrial experiment differ from what it would have been had she not plunged from the Pleroma and materialized into the planetary setting for the experiment? Question mark. From this initial question, others can be generated. A number of others naturally suggest themselves. For instance, how does Sophia's condition of material embodiment, that is to say, material immanence, affect her options for achieving the intervention that she dreamed from the Pleroma. As you contemplate this riddle, I'm sure that you yourself can come up with variations. I'm sure that you as crew members can formulate in your own minds and among yourselves in conversation variations of the riddle or ramifications of the riddle, that is to say, more particular and exact questions that arise from the primary question: how would her intervention have been different had she not materialized in the planet? And how will the achievement of her intervention now occur differently from the way it would have occurred had she not materialized in the planet? The materialization of the Aeon was something she herself did not anticipate when she dreamed the intervention scenario from the Pleroma. Isn't that correct? Let's go back and recall the amplification of the sacred narrative in FGS 2.0. Observing the seating of the Anthropos in the galactic limbs, Sophia in the company of the Aeons, including Thelete and Christos, were, let's say, surprised to see that in 9 different planetary settings, the experiment with the Anthropos plasm crashed. And so, like all good scientists, they observed the experiment. They did not meddle in it. They let it unfold in their own terms. And they considered, through their observations, why this happened. And of course, we still need to answer that question, don't we? Why did it happen? What is it about the calibration of the Anthropos that causes it to turn against its own environment as it did in those 9 instances, which can be correlated to the 9 avatars of Vishnu? Bearing in mind, however, that the 9 avatars of Vishnu, the dreaming god, never really happened. They were simply fantasies in the mind of the Aeon Sophia. They were scenarios that she dreamed as she placed herself in these 9 failed experiments, as if she had said to herself, well, if I had been able to intervene in that experiment along the lines of the avataric method, which Aeons are known to use, then I would have intervened in this way, and I would have saved or corrected the experiment in this way. The Aeon Sophia, in her youthful audacity and in her precocity as a generator, dreamed these hypothetical scenarios. And then finally, she dreamed a 10th one. She rehearsed the rescue scenario in 9 instances. And then she allowed her imagination to construct another experiment, a 10th experiment, Anthropos 10. That is the human species up to this moment. And she made a pact with that species, with the Anthropos, which was already existing out there, suspended in the Orion Nebula and seeding itself in planetary worlds throughout the galactic limbs. She made a pact, she made a promise to that luminous child. And she pictured and constructed in her mind an intervention scenario. We know that the elements of that scenario are preserved in their purest form by our Andromedan doubles on M31. We also know that we have the opportunity to approximate the terms of her intervention by looking at the details of the myth of Perseus and Andromeda. The elements of that myth: Andromeda the chained woman, Cetus the monster, Perseus the hero or avataric figure with his accessories, the helmet, the cape of invisibility, the winged shoes or sandals of Hermes, and the head of the Medusa. These elements in the Greek myth recall or approximate how Sovaya planned and pre-envisioned her intervention, which is now underway. But as we know, it is underway in conditions that are rather different from those that she preconceived in the Pleroma. The materialization of the Aeon, Sophia, into the planet Earth changed the fate of that Aeon, you could say. It certainly changed the circumstances in which she can achieve her intervention, didn't it? The circumstances now of the divine experiment that she preconceived are not exactly as they were when she conceived them in the Pleroma. So the amplification of those elements of the sacred narrative in FGS 2.0 bring us now to FGS 3.0. What do we do with the riddle, and the central riddle of correction? Well, follow Rilke's advice and live the riddle. There is no single answer to this riddle. In fact, answering this riddle is now going to be a never-ending process. Answering this riddle is the activity of participating in her correction. The answer to the riddle is participation in particular and concrete aspects of her correction as it plays into human reality. We are the human animals in the social reality of life on this planet. And the answer to the central riddle of correction comes through how we behave, through the realizations that lead to the behaviors that express her correction and restore this divine experiment to its true potential and direct it toward its highest potential. This is where we stand in FGS 3.0. We stand awaiting her tulpa at the portal of a momentous discovery. The answer to this riddle is something to be discovered. It is not something to be merely stated. So following Rilke's advice, we live the riddle. We live in this riddle. Stay in the story. Carry this riddle in your minds and in your hearts. And as you do so, consider these factors that I have listed here in the text for Crew Notes 22 at the conclusion of the text. Consider these factors, yes, but do not consider them all at once. scan these factors, I strongly advise you to excerpt this list of, what is it, 10 different factors. Excerpt it from this text and print it out on a sheet of paper and keep it where you can look at it and scan it. Any single person in this experiment can possibly hold all these considerations in mind at the same time. And in fact, your mind, once it is introduced to these factors within the narrative framework of the story, will itself select which of the factors to explore and develop at each particular moment of your day, on each particular day of your life. If you go over these factors and just scan them and read them quickly, you will then find that later on, without choosing one consciously, you don't have to, that your mind will make the choice. Your attention will collect those considerations that are immediately revealing. You are, at different moments, ripe to understand each of these different factors, but you cannot possibly understand them all at once or hold even two or three of them in your mind at one time. It is just too vast. But your first attention can act like a magnet that is being drawn through over a sheet of paper spread with metallic filings. As you draw the magnet over the sheet of paper, it draws to itself, out of the layer of metal filings, it draws certain of those filings, and they stick to the magnet. This is exactly how it will be for the remaining year of this experiment. Draw the magnet of your mind again and again over these 10 considerations, and then let your mind itself select the one that you can concentrate on, because that is the one that you can develop. That is the one that is ripe for you. You are ripe for it. You are ripe to understand something about this consideration as you live the riddle. So let me just quickly, without too much commentary or elaboration, run over these 10 items. Number one, polarities of divine imagination. That is the subject of NAV briefing 59, so I leave it to that. Two, the separation of the sexes, and of course, the healing of the separation of the sexes. Recall that the separation of the sexes was not a condition that she faced in her original dreaming. Separation of the sexes happened due to Sophia's own action once she had plunged from the galactic core. She sheared the Anthropos template as she was in the down-spiraling torque of materialization toward becoming this planet. And in that down-spiraling torque, she pulled into the process of materialization those components of the Anthropos template biased toward the female gender and toward the female or left-handed chirality of nature. That is why left-handed chirality dominates in the terrestrial world. And that is why the first human organisms derived from the Anthropos 10 plasm were all female. The first human inhabitants of the planet Earth were exclusively women. And that is why today in mitotic reproduction, both members of both sexual genders, male and female, must be born out of the female body. They are born out of the female form. And as you probably know, the ground plan or phylogenetic matrix for each newborn human animal is female. We are all born into the female matrix within the body of the mother. And only when the Y chromosome comes into play does that female template morph into the male, and a male child is born rather than a girl child, rather than a female child. So there's plenty of evidence here of the effects of the separation of the senses. Consistent with the riddle, we can ask, well, does Sophia just have another problem on her hands because she shared the Anthropos template? She never envisioned she would do anything of that sort. Or could she in some way use the healing of the separation of the sexes to achieve her correction? Could she turn an accident into an advantage? Could she turn the separation of the sexes to her advantage? You see, this is one of those secondary or tertiary questions that comes out of the primary riddle, which I call the central riddle. The central riddle remains central, okay? It remains central in your mind, central in your first attention, central in the portal of your second attention or your dreaming power. And generated around it are the secondary and tertiary questions, such as this one. Could Sophia use the separation of the sexes as an advantage in her correction once she overcomes its negative and compulsive side effects, of course? Item number 3, activation of phylogenetic memory, continuity versus amnesia. Not only is the Aeon Sophia autistic, or at least she has been for a long period of time, but she suffers from amnesia and a break in continuity, not due to her autism, but due to the fact that the human species is the critical memory circuit for her continuity. And if the human species memory circuit is damaged, as it is, she cannot have continuity either, because she has phylogenetic continuity of her own experience through the human species. So, how will she restore the human species from amnesia so that we can enact the phylogenetic memory and therefore serve as her memory circuit? Another secondary or tertiary question generated from the riddle. Number 4, her instrumentation for interactivity, the Shakti cluster. Well, she's made a tremendous step toward correction. In 2008, she broke through with a signal to humanity. She was able to provide simple and elegant instructions for interactivity. Now, the Shakti cluster is the instrument panel for this interactivity. It has a temporal aspect, the lunar cycles. It has a spatial aspect, the zodiacal constellations, the real sky zodiac of 13 constellations. And it has a material aspect, which is the sensorial, somatic, and sexual magic of the central pentagram of the Shakti cluster, with VV at the center of that pentagram. The Shakti cluster has temporal, spatial, and material properties, all of which are magical properties for interactivity between human animals and the planetary animal mother. Now, I'd venture to say that the Terma of Gaia Awakening and the Shakti Cluster indicate the measures that Sophia herself has taken to ensure that she has full interactivity with the Anthropos. She takes these measures at the moment that she proceeds to undertake the mutation of Anthropos 10 into Anthropos 11. This is already one difference. One, the first, possibly, I would say. Yes, most certainly. This is the first difference that can be identified against the terms of the riddle. Her intervention now is different because being in material immanence within the experiment, she can produce the subsequent and mutated version of the Anthropos without concluding the experiment. She can produce it at the last moment of the concluding experiment. Just imagine that. Go back and consider the other 10 experiments. Excuse me, the other 9 experiments. Anthropos 1, Anthropos 2, Anthropos 3, Anthropos 4. These were strains of the main Anthropos germ plasm deposited in the Orion Nebula. These strains went out in the form of propagules carried by plasmatic filaments into planetary worlds where they seeded and the experiment thus unfolded. But just imagine there was the experiment with Anthropos 4 on some planetary world in the galactic limbs of this galaxy, and the aeons are observing the experiment with Anthropos 4 from the Pleroma, and they do not interfere with Anthropos 4 within the limits of that experiment. Anthropos 5 is another strain. Anthropos 6 is another strain. These are all different strains, one strain to each experiment. That is how it would have been had she not materialized into the planet. But now she can transmute Anthropos 10 into Anthropos 11 within the conditions of this experiment. Okay. And she uses the instrument of the Shakti Cluster to do that. This is magic, folks. Planetary Tantra. Interactive magic with Gaia. I couldn't define it better if I did it myself. Okay? 5. How will she accomplish the outreach of humanity toward the new experiment? That is to say, toward the corrected experiment. How will she accomplish or orchestrate the outreach of humanity through the revival of the indigenous genius of the races, as I've suggested? Item number 6. The epiphany of the primary substance body of the Aeon Sophia is the organic light. Now, this was not an original condition either. When Sophia dreamed the laboratory planetary experiment of Anthropos 10, she did not conceive that she as an aeon would be materially immanent in that planet. Because she is materially immanent in this planet, we can encounter her primary substance body as an aeon, that is to say, the living presence of the organic light. That is an anomalous condition due to her plunge, not an original condition. And so it follows that the disclosure of the existence of the organic light and of its nature and properties, and the disclosure of the correct ways to proceed in encountering the light, represents a tremendous part of her correction, doesn't it? And this is a subject relating very closely to my reconnection with Graham Hancock. Because when you listen to the TED lecture, which was repressed, and which is currently being widely discussed in some circles on the internet, you will see that Graham Hancock raises the issue of cognitive liberty and the necessity for the sanity of our species of using the psychoactive plant medicines provided by Gaia herself. More to say on that in upcoming briefings, as I have more interaction with Graham and I clarify the matter of common interest to us at this point, Graham and myself. I clarify the matter of common interest, the issue of cognitive liberty, which is really bringing us back together, and I also clarify the differences in my view on that subject contrasted to his view. Okay, item number 7. Just physical, astronomical, geophysical conditions are different now than they would have been had she not plunged. So the Aeon Sophia, as the mother ship and captain of the ship, remember, I'm not the captain, I'm just the navigator, the captain of the ship and the mother ship itself must deal with the general effects of self-propulsion and self-navigation, which are unique to her correction. Okay? 8. Defeating the Archons. Remember, the presence of the Archons and their intrusion upon the Antipos was not a condition of her original dreaming, but she made a provision for that condition before she totally materialized into the earth. And what was that? She endowed humanity with the luminous epinoia. So the way that we use the luminous epinoia to manage the Archons and defeat the effect of the Archons upon this experiment is, of course, crucial in correction. And that luminous child, as Sophia envisioned, is now something that even she herself didn't realize it would become. Because that luminous child that she invoked before she became the Earth was Anthropos 10, the initial subject of this experiment. But now that luminous child is truly her child, imminently her child, as she mutates Anthropos 10 into Anthropos 11. So Sophia stands to realize the promise of that luminous child in a way even, I won't say even greater, but in a way that is somehow profoundly different from what she herself imagined in that scenario, which I have often cited, when she predicts the defeat of the Archons through the power of the luminous child. How wonderful is that? Coming down to 9, the revelation of her method. Okay, there are some days when you're going to find that the Perseus-Kalki scenario and the enigma of Medusa and the achievement of Sophia's tulpa, that is to say, the 7th identical node in the lucid dream of the wisdom goddess, float in your mind with a particular vivacity and a particular power of revelation to you. A particular power of illumination and inspiration comes from contemplating the scenario of Kali Kalki. Finally, a couple of other points. Mephisto, how is humanity going to break away from the lie? I prefer the term breakaway to awakening. I don't think there's going to be a massive social awakening in the herd, because the intelligence of the human animal simply is not amenable to such an awakening. Besides, there does not need to be a massive awakening, because the herd operates always on the direction of a small faction of members of the herd, of a small number of human animals. So it's enough for a small number of human animals to be awake in order to direct humanity on a path to sanity and healing. But society must break away from the lie and Mephisto rules. How will this be accomplished in correction? And how will it be accomplished in a way that would be different than before, had she not become the setting of the experiment? And finally, what happens to Mantis? How does she deal with Mantis? As I've said, some of you may not find that that element of the narrative works in your imagination, and some of you do, so it's optional. But there are days when Mantis comes to mind. And all I can say is, when you contemplate Mantis or any other of these other 10 points, be sure that you stay in the story. And I propose to you now that repeating to yourself and memorizing the central riddle of correction, either in the provisional language I've given or in your own language, is a practice to keep you centered in the story. So do it. So use it. Use the central riddle to center yourself in the momentous process of discovery that now unfolds.